Hello everybody. So I'm going to present you some of our work on searching for the footprints of natural selection in the human genome. And most we have a kind of emphasis on host pathogens interactions and innate immunity system. So just to give overview of what which are our interests, are kind of like the interests of everybody to try to understand and distinguish and quantify the relative effects of demographic history and natural selection on human genome variability at the population level, with an emphasis to understand how pathogens have exerted selective pressures on human genes, and more particularly human genes involved in innate immunity, and you will see why I'm talking about innate immunity. And finally, also identify genes that have played a major role in host defense against pathogens and distinguish them from those playing a kind of redundant and dispensable role in host defenses. So we have kind of three angles of research. The first one is like demographic inference per se, and also to robustly infer natural selection. We have a kind of classical approach in which we simulate different demographic scenarios, either worldwide or at a microevolutionary scale, as you will see in a minute. We compare with empirical data. Mostly we resequence regions of the genome that are non-coding, that are 300 kb away of any known or predicted gene. We have a number of criteria to minimize the effects of natural selection and to maximize the fact that this sequence may reflect only demography. We also do some kind of phylogeography with Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA. All that to... Do I speak too quickly or it's okay? Okay. To have an idea of the demographic history of modern humans, and also to calibrate the model we are going to use to robustly infer the action of natural selection. And then we go to the second angle, that we use either genome-wide data to detect natural selection in a blind way over the genome, using data that are public, like HapMap data or PearlGen data, or we have our own resequencing projects. You will see one of the examples on gene families involved in early contact between the host and the pathogens, therefore innate immunity. And that, as I told you, to distinguish between genes playing a major role in human survival from those that are more redundant. And we also characterize the functional consequences of mutations that we found in genes exhibiting strong signatures of natural selection, all that put it into a context of epidemiological and clinical data. And our third angle, that from is the only one I'm not going to talk, but I think Luis Barreiro is going to talk a bit on Friday. That is the one that I found more amusing, is to introduce another force in those forces shaping the patterns of genetic diversity in humans, that is cultural forces. As a model, we compare like hunter-gatherer lifestyle with agricultural lifestyles, and this in Africa, as you know, around 3,000 years ago in Africa, agriculture originated over here and was mainly associated with Bantu expansions and a sedentary lifestyle. So what we do is we do resequencing studies of non-coding regions in pygmy hunter-gatherers and agricultural populations, first to establish the demographic history and interactions between different pygmy groups and their neighboring agricultural population, and then we also sequence regions of the genome that we suspect that may be differently selected in hunter-gatherers and in agriculturalists, like genes involved in nutrition and mostly also genes involved in response to pathogens, because we do know that the demographic explosion when agriculture originated involve a different relation with pathogens due to population density, zoonosis, sedentary contamination associated with fecal contamination, etc. But I'm not going to talk about that. So I hope you've seen in the last weeks or months or so that each different type of natural selection will leave a characteristic signature in gene topologies, in nucleotide diversity and the allele frequency spectrum. So each one of these signatures we can kind of unmask with resequencing studies, and we are going to use different tests that make use of different genetic signatures. Each one varies depending on the time scale and at which you are looking the selective signature. So you have, if we want to see what make us humans, basically, to caricaturize a bit the situation, which are the genes that have actively participated in making us humans, we will compare with our closest primate relatives or in a time scale around 5 to 6 million years ago, and we will look at the proportion of functional changes with McDonnell-Kreitman's or KAKS test that you all know. Then we can look at the heterozygosity or the number of singletons, rare alleles, and we are in a time frame more that coincides more with just the origin of modern humans. We can also look at the number of high-frequency derived alleles, and we go a bit closer in times to the present, and then we have the face and age test. And then we can look at population differences that basically consists, if you look here, at the time of the out of Africa exodus, and we will compare population difference between major ethnic groups, and this is usually done by means of FST, and I will spend a while, the first time of my talk, on a project we've done on FST. And then you've probably heard, or you will hear from other people, that also we can look at the length of haplotypes at events of much more recent positive selection in the last 30,000 years or so. You've seen a number of different tests develop in the last 5 years. So the first example I'm going to talk is a genome-wide approach in which we've looked for the effects of natural selection in the processes of population differentiation of modern humans. So there have been quite a lot of studies in the last years looking at the genome-wide signatures of natural selection. Some of them look at the species-wide level, so they do not look at differences between populations. They look at us as an entire species, and they compare all of us, whatever is our geographic or ethnic origin, with chimps or with rat or with mouse or with whatever you want to compare, and they kind of extract genes that may have participated in what we are. So genes involved in spermatogenesis, so in speciation, in possible higher cognitive function, etc. Then there's other genome-wide studies that they concentrate on within humans, once in our species. Well, the first were done based on STR loci, but most of the late studies have used LD-based methods to detect recent positive selection, or also allele frequency spectrum of different summary statistics. The point is that most of these studies use what's called an outlier approach. An outlier approach is just that you have different statistics, such for example, you have two genus D, so you have a distribution in the population here, and you say this part here and this part here are outliers, so the genes that are here for whatever summary statistics, in this case is the genus D, and the ones that are there are under selection or may be under selection. The same for FST, that is the example I'm going to give you, and I want to convince you that what we have done is not an outlier approach. FST in humans, more or less, you will have this is zero, this is one. FST, for those that are not familiar with, is just a measure of population differentiation that goes from zero, means no difference, to one, that means absolutely different, completely differentiated for that given SNP. In humans will be more or less like that, the distribution of FST. And this more or less, it's very bad drawn here, but this will be around 0.15, right? So forget the scale, this will be much longer. Okay. So basically what has been done is to say those genes that are here and those genes that are here are outliers, so selection might be ongoing there. I will show you how we have kind of circumvented, because we, in any case, we expected genes that will be there and genes that will be there. So among those, we don't know which are the ones that are actually under selection. So what we did to do that is the questions we addressed were, to which extent we didn't want to do just a scan of natural selection in the human genome. We wanted specifically to address that question. We are all different in terms of benign phenotypes. We can be taller, shorter, fatter, darker, lighter, whatever, and also in terms of susceptibility to disease. So all this process of observable population differentiation that we observe today in humans mainly result from drift, or have natural selection helped somehow each of these populations to better adapt to their environments and therefore contribute to the current phenotypic variation of modern humans? So this is the first question we address. And the second one is, if natural selection have participated in this population differentiation processes, which are the type of genetic variants mainly targeted by natural selection? But for that, we have first to understand well what's population differentiation. Here we are always in the time frame of the last 60,000 years, more or less. We have the ancestral African population, and there's a split. To make it simple, I haven't added Asians, so let's just focus on Africans and Europeans. There's no selection here, it's just under strict neutrality. So we come to till today, and the allele frequencies of this mutation will fluctuate over generations just by drift. So today, the mean levels of population differentiation between Africans and Europeans under neutrality will be from 0.10 to 0.15. But natural selection can reduce population differentiation. How? If we have negative selection, imagine that this is the ancestral population, and we have a very low frequency of mutation that confers you selective disadvantage. So this mutation is inherited by the two daughter populations, and we come till today. It can increase a bit in frequency, but will decrease because negative selection will keep this mutation at lower population frequencies because it's weakly deleterious. For that particular mutation, if you measure the levels of population differentiation, will be almost zero because this mutation won't increase in frequency in any of the populations, assuming that negative selection is common for both. Balancing selection, you know what it is. Is the advantage in that case of an heterozygote state. So assuming that balancing selection is operating worldwide, that this is not the case for all genes, you can have balancing selection just in Africa, but we are not going to complicate more the story. This is kind of what I call, well, universal balancing selection. Everybody, independently of the environment, the heterozygote is advantage there, so you will have also very low levels of population differentiation under balancing selection. Whereas positive selection, you have this mutation here that is inherited by both, but there is a difference now, and is that a different selective pressure operating in Africans with respect to Europeans. Let's say malaria. And this mutation confers you a higher protection against malaria. So this mutation over generation will tend to increase in frequency in Africa, but not in Europe. So for that particular mutation, we will have like a maximal FST value, maximal population differentiation.
Regional negative selection could do the same thing, right?
Sorry?
Regional negative selection could do the same thing, right? So you start with something that is reasonable frequency in both, and then is suppressed in one.
Yeah. Yeah, should lead to the same thing, yeah.
And in a negative case, relative probabilities might still be very large, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking... So you may...
Say it again.
Well, in a negative selection case, relative probabilities may still be very large in those two populations.
Very large in terms of what?
Well, in probabilities. So they're both small, but, you know, orders of magnitude different.
Yeah, well, this is like, this is a cartoon that is a caricature of what's happening in real life. I mean, FST of zero is very rare. You will see now that we will compare different FST values. Okay, so basically what we did was to measure the degree of population differentiation of HapMap phase 2 data. It's around 2.8 million SNPs, but we divided the all SNPs in physical location, so genic and non-genic, and those who are genic we divided into synonymous, non-synonymous, intronic, and located in untranslated regions. So the rationale is that under neutrality, FST, as I told you before, is determined by genetic drift that will equally affect all SNP classes. And we've seen that natural selection will negative unbalancing tend to decrease FST, whereas positive selection tend to increase it. So basically, the rationale is the following. Here you have the representation of each type of SNP class in the human genome. So here is the proportion of all SNPs plotted against the FST values. For each bean or FST, the proportion of each type of SNP class should be maintained. There's no reason for which, for example, if non-synonymous mutations represent the 0.53% of the genome, that you will have in a particular FST bean, that means in a particular level of population differentiation, more non-synonymous mutations than expected. If there is, that means that something is going on for non-synonymous mutation, making increased population differentiation in a given FST value. So under neutrality, the proportion of each SNP class should be maintained in each FST bin of the global distribution. Any significant deviation in the degree of population differentiation, so in FST, between SNP classes should reflect the action of selection. So we measure FST for the 2.8 million SNPs of HapMap. The mean value is around 0.12, and we see that in most of FST bins, there are the different SNP classes follow the same distribution. But if you zoom in here, of course, as you can see, there's much more SNPs in the genome presenting low FST values, and there's very few presenting extreme FST values, that mean extreme population differentiation. So let's zoom in here. And what we observed is that there is this is the proportion of SNPs with FST lower than 0.05. So very low FST values. And we compare all SNP classes with non-genic SNPs, assuming that no genic SNPs are those that are not under selection. Okay? You will say that it can be false, this assumption, that we know that there is selection going on in non-genic regions. But still, if it's true, our comparison is highly conservative, because if there's a difference, even if in non-genic SNPs there is selection, that means that the difference is quite important. So what we observe basically is that low FST values, so low levels of population differentiation, are highly enriched in non-synonymous mutations. So, the problem, this is with the HapMap data, and is that HapMap is known to be quite a lot of bias in terms of a SNP ascertainment bias. Moreover, HapMap is known to have been enriched in non-synonymous SNPs, whatever the frequency was, whereas the other SNPs that were typed in HapMap, they follow a number of criteria like a MAF higher than 0.05, etc. So what we wonder if the excess of non-synonymous SNPs showing low FST values is just due to this enrichment of HapMap data in low-frequency non-synonymous SNPs. So in order to see if this was due to a bias, what we did was to choose of the HapMap data of the 2.8 million SNPs the so-called class A Pearl Gen SNPs. this class A Perl gen SNPs, it's a class of SNPs that were discovered regardless of, by a resequencing scheme basically, regardless of their frequency, their position. So basically there were regions of the genome that they were completely resequenced, and all these SNPs comes from that. So there was no bias of frequency here. So we did the same analysis, and what we observe is that the excess of non-synonymous variants presenting very low levels of population differentiation was kept with this kind of homogeneously biased data set, that is the Perl-gen one. So, but this excess of non-synonymous variants presenting low levels of population differentiation can be due either to the effects of negative selection, that keeps this non-synonymous mutation at low population frequencies because they are deleterious or weakly deleterious, or balancing selection. There's an excess of intermediate non-synonymous variants in all populations leading to low levels of population differentiation. So what we did to understand which of the two selective regimes may account for by this excess of non-synonymous mutations at low, showing low levels of population differentiation, is we constrain our analysis by similar bins of allele frequency. Here you have the proportion of SNPs with FST lower than 0.05, but for different bins of allelic frequencies, for HapMap and for Perl gene class A data. And what we observe is that the excess of non-synonymous SNPs is restricted to basically the colors means significant or not significant, right? So red is less than point, is basically less than 10 to the minus 3, this is less than 0.05, and the others are not significant. So what we saw is that regardless of the data set, the significant excess of non-synonymous SNPs presenting low FST values is restricted to low frequencies instead of intermediate frequency bins, that is what we would expect under balancing selection. So, suggesting that this excess is due to the effects of negative selection. Next, what we did was for the 15,000 non-synonymous SNPs of the HapMap, we predicted using PolyFen the effects on fitness. For those that are not familiar with PolyFen, PolyFen just consider the conservation of that mutation among multiple species, the consequence of that mutation on the tridimensional structure of the protein and other factors, and basically predicts a given non-synonymous SNPs to be benign, possibly damaging, and probably damaging. And what we observe is that in the proportion of non-synonymous SNPs presenting low FST values are highly enriched in SNPs that are possibly and probably damaging, being these SNPs presenting these SNPs lower allele frequencies, so that's the mean minimum allele frequencies with compared to all non-synonymous SNPs altogether or the benign, and that in low FST, low allelic frequencies here, you can see that there is an excess of possibly damaging or probably damaging SNPs. So altogether, what this suggests is that negative selection maintains these weakly deleterious mutations at low population frequencies. But the next thing we did here is very obvious, this kind of difference, but we did a zoom in here where there is much less proportion of SNPs in the genome presenting extreme levels of differences between populations, right? So if we zoom in here, we calculate for the whole series this lambda value that is not other thing that the ratio between the expected number of even a SNP class with respect to the observed number of each SNP class in a given FST bin. And what we observed that for FST higher than 0.65, what in humans is huge, is extremely rare to find mutations with such high levels of population differentiation, there is an excess of mutations that are non-synonymous mutations, are mutations located in the 5 UTR.
Can be expected is non-coding? How do you get the expected?
The expected is the, for example, here, the expected for non-synonymous SNPs, for example, is the proportion of non-synonymous SNPs over all SNPs. Okay, so over the 2.8 million SNPs that we are playing with, which is the proportion of non-synonymous? 0.53%. So this is what we expect, and the neutrality to be present in each FST bin. And the observe is the one that we observed. If we observe more non-synonymous SNPs than expected, given the frequency of non-synonymous SNPs in our data set, is that something is going on, right? So it's more clear here. Here is what we did. Again, this is the proportion of SNPs presenting FST values higher than 0.65. And what we see is that there's an enrichment of genic SNPs. This is what we expect. Let's assume that non-genic is what we expect under neutrality, even if we know that it's not true, but it doesn't matter for our analysis because it's conservative. So what we are sure is that this excess is an excess of genic SNPs presented higher FST values, and that is mainly due to an excess of non-synonymous variants and variants located in 5' UTR. We did replicate the same with the Pearl-Gen class A homogeneously biased SNP dataset, and basically we observed the same excess of genic SNPs presenting extreme levels of population differentiation, mainly accounted for by non-synonymous SNPs. We lose the signal here of 5' UTR because there's much, I mean, you don't have to forget that for positive selection and for high FST values, now we are dealing with few amount of SNPs. So in that case, there was just, for example, 1,000 SNPs located in the 5' UTR variant. So we have much less power than when we are dealing with negative selection, that there's a huge amount of SNPs presenting low FST values.
Is it the proportion of SNPs in the whole millions of SNPs?
That's what you expect. Yeah, right. So a strong population differentiation at some genic SNPs, particularly non-synonymous variants. So the next question, we wanted to match to see if this excess of non-synonymous and 5' UTR variants was replicated by constraining the analysis for similar allele frequencies, and we observed that mainly is conserved in the different allele frequency bins in HapMap, as you can see, and in PearlGene dataset. So the next logical question is, for those, we couldn't do that because it's too tedious for negative selection, because we have hundreds of thousands of SNPs presenting an excess of low population differentiation that could be due, as we proposed, to negative selection. In that case, what we did was to look where the non-synonymous SNPs and 5' UTR SNPs, in which genes they are located, because we have much less. It's around 600 here. And this is like a kind of summary table of around 500 genes that present extreme levels of population differentiation. So we have genes presenting either a non-synonymous mutation or a mutation in the 5' UTR that are extremely differentiated between populations. We found genes involved in morphological traits, skin pigmentations, hair development, what's a kind of good internal control, because as you know, we don't need to do genetics to see that there's this kind of difference. So if we found that, that means that somehow it's reassuring. We found also genes involved in immune response to pathogens. This is quite interesting group. This is just a summary. But for example, this gene is interesting because this CR1 has been somehow associated with the severity of malarial attacks in Papua New Guineans. And what we identify is a mutation whose derived state is present in 85% of Africans, but who's completely absent elsewhere. That's quite a particular situation. So that, if I was working on, for example, malaria genetics, this is one of the genes I would prioritize in the studies. Then we have genes involved in DNA repair and replication, and you will say, how, if this is kind of universal function, can be so differentiated between populations? But some of them, I remember well, if I remember well, this one is due to DNA repair following UV light. So you don't need the same levels of DNA repair if you are in Stockholm than if you are in Dakar, for example. Insulin regulation, this is very interesting. All what's metabolic syndrome, obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. We do know that there's difference between ethnic groups, regardless of the socioeconomic status in terms of obesity, basically. And this is something to be studied further. And mainly all these genes whose function seems to be unknown and show extreme levels of population differentiation. What for me is more interesting here is if you look genes that are in bold, I don't know if you can see it, the ones that are in bold, but there's some that are in bold. These genes that are in bold correspond to those that not only present extreme levels of population differentiation, but also they show significant enrichment in EHS values, that it's just a measure to detect high, long haplotypes associated with the given mutation. What does it mean? This means that these genes have been under recent positive selection, because still they have the signature of a long haplotype surrounding the gene, but that the recent positive selection has been so strong and the selective coefficient has been strong enough to lead to high levels of population differentiation. This analysis is very conservative because, for example, the lactase gene, I don't know if you've heard about or somebody has talked about that, but it's like kind of classical gene. Is one of the genes in the human genome showing the strongest selective coefficient. It's not our analysis didn't pick this gene up, so that's kind of why, and it's because the lactase gene show an FST value of 0.63 and our criteria was higher than 65. So this means really very, very high levels of population differentiation.
Can you estimate the expected number of false positives in that list?
Yes, the expected number of false positives is around 30%. Why? Because we have to go there. Okay. We expect around 30% to be in the list randomly. And that case, it's very interesting your question, because in that case we are doing an outlier approach. But is this what distinguishes our approach from an outlier approach? But what we can estimate is that 66% of the 585 genes, I wouldn't say are, but may be really under selection. The point is that which ones, I cannot tell you. Maybe this is a false positive. I don't think this is a false positive because there's functional studies supporting it. There's many others. But we'll be around 33%.
Yeah. Are you surprised by the decoupling of the non-synonymous from synonymous differentiation there? I would have thought perhaps
more overlapping.
Yeah, overlapping.
Yeah. Well, actually, there is a bit.
Theoretically?
I see, in the HapMap, it doesn't seem. But I mean, I will always believe much more the Pearl Gene Class A. There is an excess, maybe less, but some of them are just those that are in linkage disequilibrium with the non-seen animal. So I would expect, yeah. I mean, I've even surprised that to not find more synonymous mutations showing high population differentiation.
So I'm just wondering whether another approach you might take, this, rather than just pooling all the non-synonymous, because that's what you've done for a gene, to look at the non-synonymous differentiation rate,
yeah,
is to actually pool synonymous and non-synonymous, like within exons or something like that, because in many cases the exons can be quite physically separated.
No.
A particular amino acid that's differentiated, then yeah. Perhaps the synonymous sits around it in that exon or in that vicinity.
They will be hitchhiked with. That's interesting.
Focus on non-synonymous changes and look at the differentiation around those compared to randomly picking non-coding polymorphs and focusing around those regions, something like that. Yeah. Get even stronger signal.
Yeah. I mean, you mean for distinguish those synonymous mutations that are hitchhiked with this non-synonymous one from those far away in another exon. Right, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
I have another question. So maybe you said it and I missed it. So then you have these two frequency values, and SFP is FST is a measure of the difference between them.
Yeah.
So do these pairs that correspond to your list, for example, or your high FST values, are they also unusual with respect to, say, some average frequency or like some reconstructed ancestorial frequency, or are they normal? So are they is the particularity restricted to the difference, or are they also with respect to some kind of judicious average outliers?
Yeah, at two levels. In terms, from a quantitative point of view, they are outliers in terms of that the frequency difference at a given SNP is too different between the two populations, at least too different from what is expected. And then at the qualitative level, we have also things that exist, of course, but are kind of unexpected. And this is the example I gave you of this gene, but there's others also, that is the derived state that is almost fixed in Africa, whereas the ancestral state, whereas it's not present at all in Europe and Asia. So that's the kind of examples that we can find. And in any case, the same analysis were done in separately, because this is just pulling all populations together, so our continental FSTs. But we did it then just by pairwise comparisons, for example, Africa versus Europe, Africa versus Asia, and Europe versus Asia, and the patterns remain the same, more or less. Not the same genes, but the excess of non-synonymous SNPs presenting very high levels of population differentiation kept being significant. So the next thing we did was just to say that if we take all non-synonymous SNPs and we look at the homing status, that means that this, if the corresponding gene has been involved or not in disease, we see that there's an excess of these SNPs, those presenting low FST and very high FST, that are more heavily enriched in genes known to be involved in disease. So to conclude this part and to try to answer to the first questions we were wanting to address, natural selection has participated in the processes of population differentiations in modern humans left Africa around 60,000 years ago. Negative selection has globally prevented population differentiation in amino acid altering mutations, preventing them to differentiate as much as they would under neutrality, and that positive selection has increased population differentiation in gene regions, particularly at non-synonymous variants. So the next step we are trying to do is to determine how genetic variants under selection could modulate host response to pathogens. We concentrate just on those genes now as follow-up that are involved in immune response to pathogens.
Can I ask a question? Maybe you could speculate on that at least. So this gene that had to do with UV repair, and then the difference between Stockholm and Dakar, which is correct, of course. I'm being from Stockholm. so I assume that the out of Africa theory is correct, I assume it is, that the Africans have a functional UV repair enzyme or protein or whatever it is, and then the people in Sweden don't. What's the driving force for the Swedes to lose that function? That's unclear to me.
I know very few about the skin color and all that stuff, but if I remember well, there is, in some of the genes that have been studied, is more like kind of relaxation of the selective constraint out of Africa. That means that out of Africa, you need, for example, less melanin, but at the same time, you need vitamin D. If I remember well, vitamin D is through sunlight. So the driving force will be to get vitamin D also, even and to be less protected against, I don't know, maybe somebody know better than me, skin color things.
But so to retain the UV repair function, there shouldn't be any cost associated with that, to just retain that.
To retain what?
To retain that function, to keep that functioning, there is no cost associated with that. So why? I don't know.
Well, unless that function is tied to vitamin D absorption.
Yeah.
If it were, then there would be a direct cost to maintaining those genes. But that's just one possible mechanism.
Is it clear that one mutation in a pathway will destabilize the whole pathway?
No, not obvious at all.
You have to prove that there's a functional relationship between the SNP you find and some, I mean, you've got an experiment for that. You can't just do it based on, there's no criterion that you can use, mathematical reasoning, that tell you the answer. Because it could be multiple genes are involved, and mutations just change small parameter values slightly, and the Swedes have just as much resistance to UV as the Africans.
Right.
And basically, there's this buffer.
Well, but in some cases, it's the other way. It's absolutely the contrary of what you are saying. You're talking about gene regulatory networks, but for example, in some genes like EDAR, are genes that are epistatic and are involved in different phenotypes. So in that case, it's right the contrary, because you have a given mutation that is participating in teeth shape, the consistency, or whatever you want to call, of your hair, plus the way you are going to sweat. To sweat.
But you can imagine that such things would exist, but in particular case of ultraviolet damage that causes DNA damage, which predisposes you to disease and cancer, you would imagine that the genome is less plastic. It's not just tolerant of...
Yeah.
Whereas in other things, it's totally tolerant and doesn't care really, because it won't kill you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason. Fitness, you know, evolution, I don't think it has anything to do with life forever. Evolution cares only so you reproduce.
Yeah.
So as long as you can live long enough to make a child, that's it. And I think each of those genes has a different function unless you explore the pathway that they operate in and figure out the higher epigenetic consequence of each of these mutations. It's interesting, but it's not definitive. And so your question is legitimate, but I don't think it can be answered in this context yet.
Do you want to do a break now? I'm going to present you this work we've done on the toll-like receptor family. So the toll-like receptors are like part of the innate immunity system. For those that are not familiar with innate immunity, well, when you are infected by whatever microorganism, you have like a cellular system, like dendritic cells, macrophages that come, and they have some receptors. Some of them are cell surface expressed, like the toll-like receptors, but then there's cetyleptins, RIG1-like receptors, and others that will recognize directly the pathogen or components that are present on the bacterial wall, for example, or DRNA or DNA from viruses, etc. So basically, the innate immunity system is the first and early contact between the host and the pathogen, and we are interested in innate immunity because this first and only contact that we have, molecularly speaking, with the pathogen, the quality of this contact, from the quality of this early contact, all the downstream adaptive immune responses will depend. So this study we've done with the toll-like receptor family in humans. There's 10 genes in humans. We have 6 of them that are expressed on the cell surface and are mainly involved in the recognition of bacterial products or products from fungi or parasites, whereas the other 4 toll-like receptors, the toll-like receptors 3, 7, 8, and 9, they are restricted to the endosomal compartment and are mainly involved in the sensing of viruses through nucleic acid recognition. Anyhow, whatever they recognize the toll-like receptors, then we'll start a cascade of signaling pathways through all these genes that are basically the so-called adapters, and all this will eventually lead to the production of inflammatory cytokines that, to make long story short, kind of destroy the pathogen, or type 1 interferon response that is mainly antiviral. Okay, so what the question we wanted to address, to which extent and how these so-called major components of the innate immune system have evolved within humans. So what we did for that is that we sequence the 10 toll-like receptors in a panel of populations of different ethnic origin, like a classical panel we are using for our resequencing studies. But in the same panel, we have also sequenced 25 regions here in blue that are non-coding, and we follow a kind of criteria similar to the ones of Anna Di Rienzo, that she's going to be here next week, I guess. So that is, we are choosing non-coding regions that are at least 300 kb of any known or predicted gene, of any known or predicted EST, that are not in linkage with nothing known to be functional. As I told you before, in order to have something that will most likely be similar with the diversity that is expected under neutrality ad hoc in our particular population panel. So the first thing we observe is something that is not very surprising in any coding region. Here you have the nucleotide diversity pi for the so-called neutral regions, so the mean of the 25 known coding regions sequence dispersed in the genome, and the toll-like receptors all size. So toll-like receptors all together, either at the global level or independently by continent, show less diversity than neutral regions. This decreased diversity is mainly due when we calculate theta pi differently for silent sites or non-synonymous mutation, is mainly accounted by a reduced non-synonymous variation in the toll-like receptors. Nothing really spectacularly new here. So what we wanted to know is how this selective constraint have, if so, differentially influenced the different members of the toll-like receptor family. And for that, what we did was to measure the intensity of two selective regimes that sometimes they are indistinctively, in terms of terminology, we talk about purifying selection and negative selection. There's like a slight difference, at least we've done a slight difference for that. So this is a method that is basically a modification of the McDonald-Kreidman. It's called random Poisson field, and what we measure is the intensity of purifying selection. Purifying selection is basically a selective regime that does not tolerate the occurrence, in our definition of this work, as you will see, does not tolerate the occurrence of amino acid variation, because this amino acid variation must be lethal. So it's immediately removed from the population. So what you will see is much less amino acid mutations that you would expect it. On the contrary, negative selection is a bit more kind of cool than purifying selection, in terms that it tolerates the occurrence of non-synonymous mutations as long as they do not increase in frequency in the population. The main difference between negative or weak negative selection and purifying selection is that in negative selection, the mutations we are talking about are weakly deleterious, but they are not lethal. Whereas for purifying selection, the mutations are lethal, so immediately removed from the population. Whereas for negative selection, you will see an excess of polymorphic amino acid variation. And why? Because they will never reach fixation, because they are negatively selected. So this is just omega, it's just to measure the intensity of purifying selection. Lower than 1, it's a signature of purifying selection. Higher than 1 is a positive selection. So what we observe was 4 genes, toll like receptors 8, 9, 7, and 3, that show strong signatures of purifying selection. So these 4 genes cannot accumulate mutations in the population that will change the amino acid sequence. This kind of dichotomy could have been random, that is, we have a group of genes evolving under a strong purifying selection, whereas the other group of genes does not deviate from neutrality. But when the interesting thing is that when we look who is recognizing what of each one of these toll-like receptors, we realize that this perfectly coincides with the 4 endosomal toll-like receptors specialized in viral recognition through nucleic acid sensing, in contrast with the other cell surface express toll-like receptors that are mainly involved in bacteria, fungi, and parasite recognition. So for the moment, but we'll come. Yeah.
So I have one question here. So you're saying like the whole receptors, these are the purifying selection or the positive selection. But can't it, you know, there's obviously some domains in that beast that gonna, if you change something there, it's gonna screw up the whole structure. That's no good. But parts, especially where it wants to recognize something or some changing patterns, it wants to have positive selection at the same time. Mm-hmm. So how does this is kind of captured in this, in these measures here? So what happens if you have, if half of that receptor is positively selected?
I haven't finished. I will come to positive selection acting here.
Can I also ask?
Yeah.
To me, this is counterintuitive. Because viruses change a lot and very fast,
yeah.
You'd think that those toll-like receptors would have to adapt to that. And while the other microbes, like bacteria, change.
Yeah, but
what am I missing here?
No, I think you are not missing anything. I mean,
in flu, for example, they recognize the viral components that you cannot change. They don't recognize neuraminidase and.
Look, you just yeah. told me out there that.
But that's on the external ones. So the external ones are under selection pressure, not the internal ones.
The toll-like receptors usually recognize components of the virus, of the bacteria, and of whatever that are quite invariable. If not, they would never stop the red queen race. I mean, these four toll-like receptors recognize what's called the PAMs. I forgot. It's like.
Still, you see a difference here.
Yeah, but. So what do you want me to go to the conclusion directly?
No.
Okay. I mean, I have some speculations too, but just wait some minutes. And also for the positive selection, wait some minutes, because this is just like the very first part.
Sorry, can you repeat what omega is? I missed what omega is.
Omega basically is the ratio between the mutation rate of non-synonymous sites with respect to the mutation rate at synonymous sites. So when you have a negative omega, you mean you have much less non-synonymous mutations that you would expect given the divergence. Okay?
And it's built on the McDonald pregnant.
Yeah.
Kind of tape.
It's like a content. Okay, so next, now here we are interested in those polymorphic amino. In those here, we are measuring the levels of polymorphism of amino acid variation. Not those that do not exist because they have been removed. Those that show an excess of polymorphism because they cannot reach fixation. And what we saw is that 3 TOLR receptors, 1, 4, and 10, that shows an excess of polymorphic non-synonymous mutations that are kept at low population frequencies, because they must be, and we'll see in a minute why, weakly deleterious. Okay?
I'm lost now. So why would negative selection result in an excess of polymorphism?
Because these polymorphisms should be fixed between humans and chimps, given the divergence, but still are polymorphic within humans. That means that they cannot increase in frequency and be in the counts of your contingency tables as fixed difference between human and chimps, because negative selection prevent them to increase in frequency.
Oh, so you mean like there's a lack of substitutions in that class with respect? Are you talking? Do you mean like that the polymorphisms are increased,
yeah,
or that the ratio of polymorphisms to substitutions is increased? I mean, I could understand that the ratio is increased because the substitutions are less. I cannot understand that the polymorphisms per se are increased.
There's more polymorphism within humans for non-synonymous mutations than fixed difference between humans and chimps. Am I right in the way I explain it? So yeah,
I think so.
You have more polymorphic non-synonymous sites than fixed difference between non-synonymous fixed difference between humans and chimps.
Yeah, but is it a property of the ratio, or is it an absolute property of the number of polymorphisms? I think that was the source of my question.
Is the ratio?
The ratio, yeah. The ratio is okay. But the ratio is different because the substitutions change.
Mm-hmm.
Not so the number of polymorphisms change.
So? I don't understand your problem.
What I'm saying is that there are fewer substitutions rather than there are more polymorphisms.
Yeah. Yeah, well, but that's...
Same number of polymorphisms, there are fewer substitutions because there's negative
selection. To me, it's, for my mind at least, it's much less intuitive like that, that to say that you have too much polymorphic non-synonymous variation because they cannot count into fixed difference. But, well, it's like the half-empty or half-filled glass.
No, it isn't. Sorry, I was also confused by that.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm talking for me. You cannot be in my mind. For me, it's much more clear like that. But I agree that must not be for everybody. So how do you want me to tell that? Repeat it, because now I'm not understanding the way you describe it.
Well, I think the way Michael said, yeah, if you look at the ratio of polymorphisms to substitution,
yeah,
you expect fewer substitutions, negative selection, so therefore the ratio is more.
Part of this problem is you don't know how many sites there are in this kind of category anyway, so you don't know how to normalize it. I mean, if you observe the data, you observe a certain number of substitutions and polymorphisms, and then to say whether the polymorphisms have gone down or the substitutions have gone up, you need to know how many there are in total if there'd been no selection, right? I mean, you...
You mean fewer substitutions that are fixed?
There's two numbers.
Sorry. You mean fewer substitutions that are fixed between species? This is what.
Fewer polymer. I mean, there's two numbers. There's the polymorphisms and the substitution. And
yeah.
As McDonald and Kreitman have taught us a while ago, then it's the substitutions is the number that is strongly affected by selection, and the polymorphisms is the number that is weakly affected by selection.
Yeah. Okay.
So for the ratio, it doesn't matter. But for the absolute numbers, there's a clear distinction.
Yeah, well, we are talking about the same thing. It's just that for me, it's more difficult to understand your way to explain it. But well, as long as everybody understands it. So the next thing we did...
The ratio, which is it's compiled.
The point is, when there's weak negative selection, polymorphism is relatively minor.
Mm-hmm.
Polymorphism goes down, but only slightly. Whereas it's divergence that drops off very quickly as gamma is negative.
Mm-hmm.
So they're both affected, but as Michael said, one that's more steeply affected is the divergence.
Okay. So the next thing we did, we have the viral versus the non-viral TLRs, and this is the proportion of different exonic variants. Okay, of course there's more synonymous variants in viral versus non-viral, because basically it's what we have used to measure the omegas and the gammas. But what's interesting, if you look at the non-synonymous mutations here and here that we predicted as being benign, so with polyphen again, possibly damaging, probably damaging, and nonsense mutations. So what we see that in viral, most of the, we know that they are under strong purifying selection, and most of the non-synonymous mutations observable at the population level are predicted to be benign. Whereas in non-viral TLRs, there's quite a substantial accumulation of possibly, probably damaging, even nonsense mutations. It's more clear if we look here, it's more clear. This is the proportion of individuals in the general population that present at least one probably damaging non-synonymous mutation or even stopped mutation. You see that, for example, for TLR receptors 3, 7, 8, and 9, these are the viral ones, there's basically one individual that present a probably damaging mutation. Whereas for the non-viral ones, you can have like higher frequencies of probably damaging, even of nonsense mutations. For example, look TLR receptor 5. TLR receptor 5, you have around 10% in that case of the European population that they have a stop codon for TLR receptor 5 that exerts a dominant effect. So that basically distinguishes somehow how some genes are less redundant and there are more redundant than others, like this one that are less redundant, and some genes may exert a kind of.
Is that correlated with temperature, do you know? In Europeans, is it seen more in Northern Europe than in Southern Europe?
Yeah, we have just two populations of Europeans. So, I
because you could imagine that if there's less bacteria, then you would evolve, you would tolerate the subcodon.
Yeah.
In the north, in Eskimos probably, you have this.
No. What we have done, on the contrary, is because this is just a general African, European, Asian thing, but we have resequenced also the 10 TLR receptors in a group of hunter-gatherers and of neighboring farmers from Gabon and Cameroon, pygmies basically. And what we observed is that not only viral TLRs are strongly constrained, but also all this that seems to be relaxed from the evolutionary constraint in agriculturally based populations like Europeans, Asians, and most Africans are also under a strong selective constraint. We are doing some simulations to see that is what to which extent the low population frequencies are kind of low population density and sizes of the pygmies may have led to this pattern that we interpret like strong predefined selection for all Toll-like receptors.
Even most dominations where there is a huge bacterial load.
Yeah, right. Because some epidemiologists of Pasteur, for example, that study some bacterial infections in hunter-gatherer pygmies and in agriculturalists see that the parasitemia and the bacterial load in hunter-gatherers is higher than in agricultural populations.
Is that?
Yeah, you would expect the other way around. If you read a lot of Jared Diamond and all this kind of, yeah. Huh?
Tuberculosis and
yes.
All these bacteria infections that we got when we started to be close to animals.
Right, not at least for what tillers concern, we get the opposite of what the popular view would say, that is, more adaptation in... Well, at the same time, you don't have to forget that in Africa, agriculture is just 3,000 years ago that appeared. So what we are observing is not agriculture. I mean, when we compare agriculturalists and hunter-gatherers in Africa, unless there was something with a super strong selective coefficient, like lactase-like or something like that, that it could be observable in 3,000 to 4,000 years. What we are observing is not that. What we are observing in terms of difference between these two populations is that they were previously adapted to different environments. Probably some, those who become agriculturalists were savanna specialized, and those who kept being hunter-gatherers were more forest specialized. But this is absolutely speculation, what I'm talking about now. But what is not speculation is that what, if we found difference, as we do find, are not most likely due to the last 3,000 years, and therefore the agricultural origins in Africa, because it's too short time, except if you have a selective coefficient that have magically invaded the population of agriculturals because of something major.
Are there other mechanisms that have taken the place of receptor 5?
Okay.
That is not needed anymore?
Yes, there are. For example, don't ask me which is the gene and the name of the gene, but Toll-like receptor 5 recognizes flagellin, for example, and there's other proteins of the innate immune system that do recognize flagellin, for example. So we are talking about redundancies like mannose binding lectin. I would say 30-40% of the European population has some mutations that makes that you don't have mannose binding lectin circulating in your serum. You are what's called MBL deficient, and we make a study in which we show, because the nice sexy hypothesis was maybe being MBL deficient has conferred you selective advantage for other things, and we basically show that MBL is like the perfect neutral gene with whose variation is distributed among populations in a super nice isolation by distant manner without of Africa and all what you want. And then when you look at you are MBL deficient, you have other genes like the selectins that are doing exactly what MBL was supposed to do. But when we say that this gene is neutral, so no effect, this does not mean, like the case of MBL, that it doesn't play a role like a gene modifier. For example, when you are MBL deficient, if you are just that, it's okay, you live perfectly your life. But if you are MBL deficient, and on the top of that, you are HIV positive, or on the top of that, you are going through chemotherapy, and on the top of that, you have some kind of immunodepression in general, in that case, it can play a little role. This extra defect.
So the loss of some of these could be compensated by the gain of something perhaps even more efficient.
Yeah.
But it's also possible you're misinterpreting the notion that this indicates relaxation of constraint. It's because, like at TLR5, you know, that's at least at the nonsense mutation, at least at the 5% frequency. It's pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
That those may be selected. If there's any kind of cost of recognition,
mm-hmm.
then perhaps there's some polymorphism. I mean, in the plant,
disease resistance genes, which act similarly in kind of innate resistance, many of those R genes are polymorphic for alleles with nonsense mutations or deletions, which knock out the genes. And in that case, you know, we've shown that the resistance alleles themselves, in the absence of the pathogen, are very costly, extremely. 10% fitness cost. That is to say, perhaps, you know, once something like a virus gets into the cell, it's a totally different story than things that are, you know, on the cell surface, just looking for the possibility that there might be, you know, a potential pathogen. Because once they trigger a response, the response is pretty costly, just energetically, and actually in the actual products they produce. So in that case, there may be some selective balance for alleles which, you know, lose that functionality and something of.
Yeah, actually, if you look at here, you will say
relaxation, the higher balance system.
Yeah, you would say in this kind of simplistic way, I'm describing these results because it's not finished. That toll-like receptors 1 and 10 are kind of redundant, but now we will see that there's like positive selective alleles in these two genes. So that's the next thing. So basically, what we did was we took all our 600 SNPs, identifying the different populations through resequencing of the 10 toll-like receptors, and we plotted, here is a plot with the 2.8 million SNPs of HapMap. This is the distribution of HapMap, but since HapMap is a genotyping-based effort, and what we had was a resequencing effort that, as you know, the resequencing has no bias in terms of you are basically observe the entire allelic spectrum, in contrast with HapMap, that we don't really know what you are observing and not. So in order to make comparable both data sets, we constrained by expected heterozygosity, that, as you know, is a product of allele frequencies, to compare things that are comparable. So we plot our toll-like receptor SNPs here, and what we observed is that there's some SNPs in the toll-like receptors. This is the 95 percentile of the distribution of HapMap, and this is the 99. So what we observed is some that are extremely differentiated among populations, because we are looking now for a positive selection action. When we look who is doing that, some of them here in green are non-synonymous and correspond mainly to toll-like receptors 1, 6, and 10. So these three genes show some extreme levels of population differentiation for some SNPs. The problem is that of these three SNPs, of these three genes, is that they are the only ones that are in the same arm of the same chromosome, and they are in linkage disequilibrium mainly in Europe and in Asia. So you have here toll-like receptor 10, 1, and 6. So we don't know who is the responsible of this potential signature of positive selection. So what we did was like kind of classical summary statistics. This is a sliding window of the whole region, and this is the nucleotide diversity pi. You see that something is going on here for Africans, something bizarre is going on in terms of nucleotide diversity in this region of toll-like receptor 1, where Europeans and Asians show much more diversity than Africans. And we did other tests like the Tajimas did, the face and age, and also here for comparison you have the DFSTs. So you see that there's some quite complex signatures in the region of potential selection. So what we did to make use of the whole resequencing data set, that since we don't have genotyping data at different physical distance in order to apply tests that are based on linkage disequilibrium and recent positive selection like LRH and IHS, and we wanted to make use of all the resequencing data within the gene, we thought about developing this test. It's called the derived intralytic nucleotide diversity test. The rationale of this test is that we have here a mutation in green that under neutrality will increase in frequency, and today this, sorry, the mutation is the derived allele, right, with respect to the chimpanzee. So a mutation appear that is derived, increase in frequency by random genetic drift, and today is associated with a given amount of variation. Here you have the derived mutation that appears, an increase in frequency by positive selection, so you have a high frequency of the derived allele but associated with very few linked nucleotide diversity. So basically we can plot the things like that. Here in green, but you see it very bad, is the frequency of the derived allele in the population, and we plot it with respect to the ratio of pi of the ancestral allele with respect to the nucleotide diversity pi of the derived allele. So basically the highest the derived allele will be in frequency, that means that it's a long time that exists in the population, so the highest the pi of the derived allele will be, so the lower the ratio will be. At low frequencies of a derived allele, that means the derived allele is young, there's not a lot of diversity, so this ratio will be high. These are simulations. So what we did was we plot our toll like receptors, the derived allele frequencies, with respect to the ratio of pi ancestral with pi derived for Africans and for non-Africans. Of course, the simulations are adapted to the best fit demographic models for Africans that involve an expansion around 30,000 years ago. It's basically the Schaffner model. And for non-Africans, the expected background of diversity involves a bottleneck of around 5 times of reduction of the ancestral African population size. Anyhow, what we observed was 2 haplotypes, one in Europeans and one in Asians, whose derived allele frequencies are too high in the populations and are associated with too low associated intralytic diversity. So these 2 haplotypes, one is what's called haplotype 34 in Europeans. You don't have to look at that. The only thing that's important here is that this is the frequency of the haplotype in the population, around 25%, and in yellow you have the mutations that are non-synonymous mutations. So haplotype 34 in Europe, I remind you that the 3 genes are in linkage disequilibrium, so we don't know which mutation and which gene is the responsible or what we are doing, but we have 2 non-synonymous mutations in toll like receptor 1 and 1 non-synonymous mutations in toll like receptor 6. Non-synonymous mutations derived in toll like receptor 10. So we did some functional studies of mutagenesis of transfection to see each one of these mutations, what is the effect on host response as measured by a classical transfected luciferase NFKB activity. And what we observe here, I'm not going to go into any detail, but here for toll like receptor 1 we have the 2 mutations, and what we observe is that toll-like receptor 1 works with toll-like receptor 2 in a heterodimer, so I don't get into the details, but basically the first mutation, that one, is this one, so do not change the amount of NF-kappa-B luciferase activity as compared to the wild type, but the second mutation, this one, reduced by half the NF-kappa-B activity, and this is the double mutation, the 2 together, to show that more or less give the same amount of luciferase activity with the single mutation one. And toll-like receptor 6, that we have to do it separately because the ligand is another ligand different from toll-like receptor 1. Here we have stop mutation already described that we put as internal control. This is the the wild-type toll-like receptor 6. This is a mutation that is known to decrease the activity of toll-like receptor 6, and this is our mutation over here that do not vary the response in terms of NF-kappa B luciferase activity. So what allows us to say that this is the mutation that may be the cause of the patterns of positive selection. And what is doing this mutation? We were discussing with him before about this mutation is reducing your response. So how can be beneficial to have a less good immune response? So toll-like receptor 1 has been shown to recognize Mycobacterium lepra, for example. And we need a kind of balance between being able to recognize the pathogen, like it is the case here, but without recognizing it too much, to avoid inflammatory or inflammatory diseases like leprosy or basically mycobacterial diseases or TB. So maybe it has been advantageous in Europe to recognize the pathogen, in that case Mycobacterium leprae and Mycobacterium tuberculosis, without having too much TLR1 mediated response that can become something against yourself, as is the case of tuberculoid leprosy and tuberculosis, that most of people working in these diseases consider the diseases like inflammatory diseases in which your immune response is too aggressive against yourself. For the haplotypes, in the other haplotype that the DIND test identify as being under positive selection is these two haplotypes in Asia that we target because the derived allele frequencies of these haplotypes is too high with respect to the internal diversity. Basically, it's the same haplotype, there's just one mutation here, non-synonymous mutations here of difference. So they do not present non-synonymous mutations in toll-like receptor 1 and 6, but they present three non-synonymous mutations in toll-like receptor 10. So I'm not showing you the results because actually the results before were finished last week, and these ones I haven't had it yet. The problem with toll-like receptor 10 is that there is no known ligand for toll-like receptor 10. So we have a problem of how to stimulate the cells to have a response. So what we are doing is just under we're doing what's called constitutive activation after mutagenesis at transfection to see the trend without a stimulation. You see a bit because the mediums are not completely free of stimuli, even if you don't know what it is. And what we are doing also is activate toll-like receptor 10 with an antibody. This is the best we can do, knowing that we don't have known ligand to activate, to stimulate toll-like receptor 10. In any case, it seems that our first results of these three mutations seems that the effects of these three non-synonymous mutations on the response is the same of a control that we have put, that is a stop mutation in toll-like receptor 10. So suggesting that this being deficient in toll-like receptor 10 has involved a selective advantage, as what you were evoking for toll-like receptor 5. Showing that it's much more complex than we previously thought in the first part of the study. And anyhow, to conclude, I'm just 3 minutes from the end, what we've seen is that there's strong purifying selection for the four genes involving viral recognition. Then why they are so constrained? Either viruses have exerted stronger selective pressures on toll-like receptors than other microbes, but we don't have to forget that these four genes also recognize something that we do have in ourselves, and is the nucleic acids. So maybe a strong constraint to prevent these four toll-like receptors to be released from the endosomal compartment and start to recognize something that we do have in ourselves, and to avoid autoimmune reactions functions is one of the reasons we propose to explain this strong constraint for the viral recognition TLRs. Another reason is the strong publication bias that there is in humans for toll-like receptors. In humans, when you talk about toll-like receptors, it's just immunity. We don't have to forget that toll-like receptors were discovered in Drosophila, not at all for immunity, but for development. So it has been recently shown that toll-like receptor 8 is in human, is involved in the development of neuronal connections during embryonic life. So maybe we are in the situation in which toll-like receptors have functions much more vital and much more like important in development than just innate immunity. So whatever is the reason by which these four genes are constrained, the patterns of variation they show makes them excellent candidates to be involved in severe phenotypes or Mendelian deficiencies of monogenic inheritance. What does it mean? We are trying to do a parallel between the intensity of selection we are observing in a gene and the kind of inheritance of the disease that he will most likely be involved. Genes that are under strong purifying selection means that these genes cannot accumulate mutations because this that changes the amino acid sequence, because the mutations are lethal. So if a mutation occurs, most probably the phenotype will be very severe. This is the case, for example, for toll-like receptor 3 that we do find under purifying selection, and it has been shown that mutations in these genes are associated with simplex herpes encephalitis, that is a very strong defect that you basically die before the age of reproduction. And for the other six toll-like receptors, we've shown that there's a kind of relaxation of the selective constraint, that they are more permissible to accumulate mutations, but it's not as simple as that, because some of them show signatures of weak negative selection that precludes some of some mutations here to increase in frequency in the population, and they are kept at low population frequencies. And then for the other cluster of genes, toll-like receptor 1, 10, and 6, they present signatures of a partial sweep in non-African populations. That means signatures of positive selection in African and in Europeans, most likely due to an advantage of having less in Europe TLR1-mediated immune response, and in Asia of TLR10-mediated immune response. In anyhow, the mode of evolution of these genes makes them ideal candidates to be involved in complex predisposition to infection at the population level. So what we are doing now, and that's the last slide, in terms of the genome-wide, we're trying to develop methods to detect the effects of balancing selection at the genome-wide scale by trying to study further FST as a function of heterozygosity in the populations, but we're trying to study that at the level of all populations, that is Europeans, Africans, and Asians, basically maximal heterozygosity for a given SNP associated with very low FST value, but also within continents with data from the HDDP CEF panel in which we have many populations per continent. And one of the other things that we are doing also is to do the same study of the toll-like receptors that we have done in humans in non-human primates, to see if this dichotomy somehow of evolution between the toll-like receptors involved in viral recognition with respect to those mostly involved in bacterial recognition is kept in chimpanzees and gorillas, or if they show different signatures of natural selection. And also we are studying also, because the toll-like receptors, as you've seen, is specialized either in viral recognition or in bacterial recognition, but there's other families that are specialized only in bacterial recognition, like the NOT-like receptors, and only in viral recognition, to see a bit what's going on. And that's the people who have participated in this. Thanks so much.
receptors, you look specifically in ligand recognition domain, or you look all over the place in the whole gene?
In the whole gene.
So then I don't quite understand. Now, there should be some sort of asymmetry between positive and negative selection, or if you like, purifying selection. Right. So I might expect if there is some strong positive selection, you might expect that it is more likely to appear in the ligand tracking domain, and we see it. But the purifying selection, imagine that it's a big complicated protein, and if it doesn't fold, the whole function is gone. So the purifying selection isn't particularly acting it as a protein, not as a receptor.
Right.
So I'd be mighty surprised that purifying selection on this fortaloid receptors is dominated by avoidance of autoimmune response constraint, right? Which only affects 20 nucleotides of 300.
I think it's an additive, because we are not proposing like autoimmune avoidance as the cause, explaining that. But I think it's not just that virus have exerted strong. I think these four genes have biological functions that are much broader than we thought. And it's just for that they are so evolutionary constrained. That is not just because of viruses and innate immunity functions. On the contrary, for
positive. The question is, if we think of sort of purifying selection perhaps being dominated just by folding constraints or something, is there some notable difference between the two classes of toluene? Why would one be so much less constrained than the other?
Because maybe the other do not have functions that are less major and vital.
Oh, I'm sorry, fine. So you're just saying it's just as likely not to fall.
Right.
But who cares?
Yeah. And the other six are more flexible. Whatever it is to be flexible for you, that is either relaxation or that are under, they show signatures of positive selection. But to comment more your first question, for the ones under positive selection, you can have either in the extracellular domain to recognize more things, also in the intracellular one, because maybe some mutation in your intracytoplasmic domain that abolish or diminish signal transduction can be also positively selected, because you will have less TLR-mediated immune response. And this, as we have seen for Europe and Asia, may have been an advantage to avoid too much inflammation.
But I guess what I think you just explained is that the difference in so the strength of purifying selection is really dominated by sort of lethality, right? So in principle, in yeast, where one can just knock things out and see what's lethal and what's not lethal, there should be a statement that now if we look at the genes that we know are lethal, we should find the stronger purifying selection signal, as opposed to genes that are redundant or synthetic lethals or something like that. And so here, I mean, you did sort of specifically say that those viral response receptors are also involved in developmental function.
What about, there's anything known about how, so I'm following up on something you said, that maybe the viral ones were all internal, the cell, and the bacterial ones are all on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe when there is a response, there is some cost for the cell in terms of energy that it consumes. So if the ones that are on the surface are, well, so there are several things I'm thinking of. Also, the internal ones, once they react, maybe there is more energy cost associated to that, so they need to be more precise. Mm-hmm. Or it can also be such that the ones on the surface, they will perhaps see more antigens, so to speak. You know, more stuff more junk is just floating around outside the cell than inside the cell. So they would have to be a little bit relaxed and maybe not react as often as those that are internal. Mm-hmm. So is there anything known about how much it costs to follow a pathway from an internal as opposed to an external? Is there anything known?
In humans, I don't think so. In plants and Drosophila, there's a lot of work that has been done that I know very, very bad. But what I know a bit is that the more you are in internal, in general, the few things I've read about that, the more constrained you will be. Right. And for our studies, I haven't talked about that because we haven't finished, but we are studying from, the outside part of the toll light receptor, whether it's its cell surface or endosomal, and we are going down through the adapters, and then NF-kappa-B, and then interference. And the more we go, for example, the adapters are super highly constrained. What's not a big surprise? You expect that because they will centralize a lot of information.
Yeah. So maybe it's not really related to virus bacteria, but to internal and external. And had it been so that you could detect virus on the outside, this pattern might have been the reverse, or that wouldn't have been the difference.
Yeah, but it's more or less the same.
Yeah, I agree. It leads to the same result, but the explanation maybe is not that one.
You mean it's more due to structural localization, cellular localization, that to. Yeah. But why then?
Well, because of the energy cost of doing something on the surface as compared to...
But I don't know anything about that. So explain me why something in the cell surface should have less cost.
Well, I don't know. I asked you if you knew about that.
I don't know.
Only thing I can think of is that on the outside of the cell, there is a lot of stuff that floats around and maybe not always is a threat. So it would be wasteful to react against that. While something that already has gotten into the cell needs to be dealt with, so that there is a stronger reason to react to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what you may think of this. I'm just speculating.
I mean, the beauty of this study is that it actually did separate those two classes.
Yeah.
Suggested they have different.
But are you aware of serious studies in which they show that the more outside you are, the less constrained you are? Because this is something that people say, but I've never really read it.
I'm not aware.
Could one look into that? I don't know how would one do that?
Guy Sella is working a bit on that, but a bit on
look at all the extracellular domains of every membrane-bound protein, the intracellular stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone's done kind of population genetics of that.
No, because
it'd probably be interesting.
Yeah. It will be very interesting by knowing the levels of polymorphism and the intensity of natural selection that is a proxy of polymorphism and all that. When you have all these kind of networks, to have people that tell you which are the pathways that are more advantaged but at the pathway level, because there's more flow or something like that, but I don't know anything about that, but I'm sure there's physicists that could do that. Why there's more flow in this kind of pathway than in that other one, and but I don't know if somebody's doing or interested in it. Thank you.